Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with historian David McCullough about the greater journey Americans made to Paris in the 19th century.
They'd never seen anything really old. Charles Sumner, one of the most important of these young Americans who went over, said he felt for the first time in his life the prestige of age.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Times business reporter Gretchen Morgenson describes her new book about the Wall Street implosion.
It's almost as if all of the major banks that are large now and interconnected and politically powerful are too big to fail, as Fannie was.
And Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news. David McCullough is one of America's most honored and beloved historians, prize-winning author of biographies of Harry Truman and John Adams. He's written a new book. It's called The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris. It's reviewed on our cover by another prize-winning historian, Stacy Schiff, who says this book is a meaty collection of short stories, expertly and flavorfully assembled, and adds up to the story of a nation growing up and also of a city coming into its own. I'm delighted that David McCullough is on the telephone with me to talk about his new book. Welcome.
Thank you.
What drew Americans to Paris in this period you describe, which began as early as 1830?
Well, those that I've written about were primarily drawn by their own ambition to make the most of themselves in the profession they had chosen. Architects, physicians, artists, writers, they were ambitious to excel, and they were mostly all young and mostly very talented, but they didn't have access in this, our country at that time, to the kind of training and the kind of atmosphere that they craved. There were no schools of art, there were no schools of architecture. Medical schools were very behind the times. So Paris was the place to be. And they went often at considerable risk, very few knowing a word of French because our colleges and universities and schools didn't teach modern European languages at that point. Many of them had very little money and knew no one in Paris. So it was a brave undertaking. And my interest was in those who wrote wonderful letters and diaries chronicling their experiences, and who had a story worth telling, but also those who brought something home, either figuratively or literally.
David, some of those who made this greater journey, as you describe it, Samuel Morse is an example, went over thinking he'd be one kind of creative person and came back as an altogether different kind.
Most dramatic example of that, to be sure, in our whole story as a country. He was a very accomplished portrait painter, never had any notion of striving for anything else but excellence as a painter. But while he was in Paris, painting what turned out to be his masterpiece, the Gallery of the Louvre, as it's called, he got the idea for the telegraph. And of course, that invention changed the world very rapidly, and in part, too, because of its coordinate invention of creation of his own, the Morse code.
David, in your great biography of John Adams, you describe how an earlier remarkable generation of political figures, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Adams, made a great impression on Paris itself. What about this next wave of creative people, artists and writers? How was someone like James Fenimore Cooper received in Paris? Did they even know who he was?
Cooper was a sensation. His novels were hugely popular and could be seen in the bookstore windows all over the city. He was treated like a celebrity. He was, in many ways, the first American celebrity to take Paris by storm. Then there were others like the painter of the Plains Indians, famous painter of the Plains Indians, George Catlin, who not only arrived with a gallery of his paintings, but with a whole group of Iowa Indians who performed. performed their dances for the king, Louis Philippe, at the Palace of the Tuileries. And later there were people like John Singer Sargent and Mary Cassatt, and Thomas Edison showed up at the famous World's Fair of 1889, the one for which the Eiffel Tower was built. And Edison was another sensation. His popularity was such that he hardly dared go out in public because so many people would swarm about him. And there was Louis Gottschalk, who was a brilliant pianist and composer, who was the first American to perform solo on stage in Paris, and did so at age 15. It's reassuring to see that it could work both ways, because those Americans who were not yet somebodies, who were there to find out if they really had the stuff it would take, would later be recognized as major figures in art or literature or the performing arts. Augustus St. Gaudens, the sculptor, being a prime example, who came over by steerage going to France from New York, where his father worked as a shoemaker. And he arrived as a young fellow of 19 years old and would later create several of his major pieces in Paris, his Farragut statue, which is now in Madison Square Garden, Madison Square in New York, and his magnificent equestrian statue of General Sherman, which is at the entrance to Central Park at 59th Street and Fifth Avenue. Both of these great works made in Paris.
David, what about cultural differences? You know, we think of the classic Henry James novel where the American innocent goes to old Europe. These were Americans who were, however brilliant, provincial in many ways, and they're going to the most culturally advanced and sophisticated city on the planet. What kind of adjustments did they make? How did it feel for them to be in a city like Paris as opposed to Boston or New York?
Big adjustment, and the beginning of a big adventure of the mind and spirit. It's why I titled my book The Greater Journey. The initial journey they had to make over the Atlantic Ocean by sailing ship in the early days was a journey of no easy experience. But when they landed in Europe, and most of them never set foot outside their own country, and they got as far as Rouen and saw the great cathedral there, it was a turning point in their lives. And this isn't just something later day historians or biographers have imposed on the experience that they had, but what they wrote about themselves. They'd never seen anything really old. One of the oldest buildings in our country was Independence Hall, a famous building in Philadelphia. It was less than 100 years old, and there they were seeing a cathedral that was begun before Columbus ever set sail. Charles Sumner, one of the most important of these young Americans who went over, said he felt for the first time in his life the prestige of age. Emma Willard, the pioneer in education for women in America, was speechless, literally speechless, and talked about the depth of the emotional depth of seeing that church. And once they got to Paris, they could go to a museum such as they never even imagined, let alone seen, the Louvre. They could go to the opera, which none of them had ever attended, see ballet. They could walk among some of the architectural treasures of all of Europe, magnificent open space parkland, which was not yet common in America. They felt alive as they never had, as they said repeatedly. It would change their outlook on not just on the possibilities of human creativity, but would change their outlook on the possibilities in their own lives, their own future, in their work.
Thanks so much, David McCullough.
Thank you very much.
It's David McCullough, whose new book, The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So you've been making that long trek to the Javits Center, the Jacob Javits Center, to observe the Book Expo. What's going on there, the big trade event, annual trade event?
Yes, this is the annual trade convention for the book industry, one of them. And this is where about 20, 25,000 authors, booksellers, publishers, editors, everybody involved with the whole process comes to New York and sees the beauty of the area surrounding the Javits Center. I certainly hope they go beyond it.
Julie, the Book Expo, or BEA, in, as it's often called, has been around for a long time. But some say it's not the critical big event it used to be, that publishers and booksellers are so often and so regularly in communication now, day to day, that you don't really need a convention for them all to come together, to convene. So what goes on now? What are some of the big issues or conversations that go on at an event like this now?
Right. It used to be that booksellers would come to the convention, talk to authors, talk to publishers, and then order in their books for the coming fall. Of course, now all of those books are already ordered, but they still talk about fall books. But really the main point of the convention, even though it's a little old-fashioned, a little quaint, is really just for everybody to get together in the same room, talk about the issues facing the industry. You have a huge exhibit floor where most publishers are represented. You have CEOs and editors and publishers wandering around and actually going face-to-face with their authors, which authors certainly appreciate. But then you also have a lot of panel discussions. You have some of the new players in the book business, like Google and Apple, who are around. And it's really kind of an opportunity for everybody to just get together.
So what's some of the news then? Publishing industry, as you've been telling us every week for quite some time now, is in what seems almost a constant state of upheaval and turmoil. Are there exciting things going on as well as alarming or depressing ones?
It is exciting. I think that a lot of publishers say, you know, that they are excited by the opportunity that ebooks have presented. A little bit of the anxiety has faded away as publishers have realized, okay, we can actually make money from ebooks. There is an enormous opportunity abroad. Some of those have not yet presented themselves.
Amazon, which has been one of the giants in the book industry for a while now, is kind of on the move again, right? Don't they have a new idea or two?
Yeah, Amazon got a lot of attention early this week when they announced on Sunday night that they had hired Larry Kirschbaum, who is one of the industry's best-known veterans. He used to be the chairman and CEO of the Time Warner Book Group. He then started his own literary agency about 5 years ago, and Amazon said that they had hired him to run a new general interest imprint for Amazon. Now, Amazon already has several other imprints, one for mystery and thriller, one for romance, and they publish ebooks as well as some print books. However, this seemed to be an imprint that would compete much more directly with what some of the bigger houses are already doing. So it certainly made a lot of publishers wonder, what exactly is Amazon up to here? Are they trying to go head-to-head with us, competing for authors? And sure enough, on Wednesday, Amazon announced that they had acquired a book by Barry Eisler, the thriller writer. Barry Eisler, a few months ago, grandly announced that he was leaving the traditional publishing industry because he was very upset with the way that his books were being handled there. So that was seen as a coup.
Julie, in years past, one of the highlights of the Book Expo, particularly for the booksellers who travel across the country for the event, has been meeting famous authors, getting their galleys signed. Any big names circulating this
time?
There
were plenty of celebrity authors hanging around. Diane Keaton on Thursday morning read from her new book, and apparently it was a very emotional reading. John Lithgow was strolling around the floor. Julianne Moore. I could go on and on, but this is actually one of the things that really makes booksellers who, you know, can be a little starry-eyed, very excited about the whole BEA New York experience.
Thank you, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Gretchen Morgenson is a Pulitzer Prize-winning business reporter for The New York Times, and her accounts of the remarkable events in Wall Street were among the most closely read in the country. Now Gretchen Morgenson and Joshua Rosner have written a new book. It's called Reckless Endangerment: How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon. It's reviewed for us this week by Robert Reich, who says the book is filled with telling details and demonstrates how the revolving door between Wall Street and Washington facilitated the charade. I'm delighted that Gretchen is here to talk about her book. Welcome, Gretchen.
Thank you, Sam.
So we're still sifting through this remarkable thing, awful thing that happened. Who are some of the big players you describe in your book?
Well, really one of the first people that we think was at the scene of this and helped create this disaster that really has not been identified as a prime mover is a man by the name of James Johnson, who was the chief executive officer of Fannie Mae from the early 90s up through 1998. That seems like ancient history, perhaps, but he really was the architect of what we call this public-private partnership, where home ownership was the goal, raising the rate of home ownership in America, the American dream of home ownership. Of course, Sam, now you know Fannie Mae is a ward of the state. The taxpayers own the company and own the hundreds of billions of bad mortgages and losses that were the result of this really disastrous partnership.
Now, Gretchen, the typical person is going to say Americans should own their own homes. I mean, was that a bad impulse, or was it the execution of that idea that got us into trouble?
It was a noble impulse. It has been a part of the American psyche for a very, very long time. Land ownership, home ownership, it's a great idea. But really, it morphed into this ugly way for Wall Street and the banking system to take advantage of first-time homeowners. It really is this really amazing paradox that the people that we were supposed to try to help become homeowners, i.e., immigrants, first-time home buyers, minorities who traditionally had not been able to, you know, scrape up a down payment to buy a home, these very people that we were supposedly trying to help are now so many more of them in foreclosure than other types of people, even among people who are financially situated similarly to them. So you see this really ugly result of what was a noble idea, and it was another example of Wall Street taking a great idea and really poisoning it.
Okay, so let's go through the steps here. You have the idea that the average person should be able to own a home, even if he or she isn't well-to-do at all. So you make it possible with lowered interest rates and all the rest. Where does Wall Street come into this?
Wall Street comes into this by creating new kinds of mortgages. They're called affordability products. As you remember, Sam, the real estate market was roaring, prices were rising. It was even becoming more difficult to get together a down payment because of the, you know, wild increases in real estate prices. So Wall Street came up with these types of loans that allowed for a low down payment, had a very low rock bottom interest rate initially, and then exploded upwards after about 3 years or so. There were loans even that allowed you to choose whether you would pay down the interest and the principal. These were called negative amortization loans. Anyway, they were affordability products designed to help people get into homes. And there was very little care and prudence done about whether or not these were the right kinds of loans for people who were financially unsophisticated.
But why does a zillionaire on Wall Street care whether he can create all these loans for poor people? What was in it for them? Why was Wall Street doing this?
Huge fees, for starters, okay? These kinds of toxic loans carried far higher commissions for the people who sold them, for the mortgage brokers, for the mortgage lenders. They were far more lucrative for the firms like Countrywide and New Century who made these loans. Then along the way, they would pool these loans. Wall Street firms would package them together and sell them to investors, making yet more fees and commissions. So it was an extremely lucrative business, this machinery of first making the loan, then selling the loans, pooling them and selling them to investors. Extremely lucrative. It created just incredible profits on Wall Street for a period of about 5 years.
Now, what about government? What about the Treasury Department? I mean, shouldn't somebody or wasn't anybody wondering about all of this?
That is a crucial question, and it's has a very ugly answer, Sam, and that is that the regulators who should have been minding this very important store were either captured by the entities that they were regulating or asleep at the switch. Particularly when you started to have these newfangled types of mortgages, it would have been far better for many of the people who got sucked into them and are now in foreclosure or have lost their homes altogether. It would have been better had the Fed taken a look at this and said, the Federal Reserve Board, and said, you know, these aren't for everyone. We should have rules and regulations about what kinds of mortgages ought to be peddled. They should have been far more aggressive with making sure that the fees, the very high commissions that were being paid to Wall Street in these cases, were not really driving the economics. And that's what, in fact, they were. So you had a failure of the regulators that was really, really crucial to the bad outcome here.
And what lessons have been learned, not by someone like you who covered it so closely, but by the people in positions of power who can change things? Have they learned anything?
Well, unfortunately, the Dodd-Frank legislation that came, that was approved last year and designed to try to make sure this kind of thing never happens again, has really completely avoided dealing with the too big to fail banks. These are the banks that are too interconnected, too politically powerful, too large to be allowed to go bankrupt. So Dodd-Frank sort of, it did a lot of other things. It took care of some of the problems, but it did nothing about too big to fail. And so the result is, you know, where Fannie Mae was too big to fail, we now have all kinds of Fannie Maes that are too big to fail. All of the major banks are too big to fail. So whereas before the crisis, we only had really Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac as government-sponsored enterprises, it's almost as if all of the major banks that are large now and interconnected and politically powerful are too big to fail, as Fannie was.
And where does this leave the homeowners who are stuck with mortgages they can't pay or who are evicted from their homes? What's the next step for them? Will the system readjust in any way that helps them?
It's been a very long time, a slow process. We still see falling real estate prices, which, of course, you know, has a circular effect, driving people and even more people out of their homes as the values fall. So we're still in the midst of it. And it really is amazing that 4 years after this crisis erupted, you know, in full bloom in 2007, we are still, as you say, excavating and trying to understand what went wrong, but we are still very much in the midst of its impact.
Gretchen, in reporting this, you are following it so closely. You met and dealt with so many people. Were you taken some places by this research that you didn't expect to end up in?
Yes, I think that the focus on Fannie Mae as the sort of template for the kinds of too-big-to-fail institutions and enterprises that we are now surrounded by, I think really excavating, going back into history and being an archaeologist, as it were, to understand how Fannie Mae became too-big-to-fail, how Congress enabled it, and how its executives manipulated lawmakers and neutered their regulators, it was a really interesting bit of investigation, because now we see it really being done by so many institutions. It's almost as if that playbook is being used now by a lot of our financial institutions.
When a very high-profile reporter like you is on a case like this, are there people who just won't talk to you?
Oh, yes. In fact, the main character in the book, Jim Johnson, would not speak to me, and I pestered him, but never responded.
Thanks so much, Gretchen.
Thank you, Sam.
That's Gretchen Morgenson, whose new book, Reckless Endangerment, is reviewed in this week's Book Review. Jennifer Schusslooser with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, not a lot of news at the top. Charlaine Harris is still at number one on the fiction list with Dead Reckoning, her latest Southern vampire novel. And James Patterson and Maxine Pietro are still at number two with 10th Anniversary.
How about World's Strangest Term nonfiction?
Not a lot of new titles up on the top over there either. Eric Larson, he was at number four last week with In the Garden of Beasts. This week he does jump to number one. I kind of expect him to hang around for quite a long while. He's followed by Steven Tyler, Does the Noise in My Head Bother You? And, you know, past couple weeks I've been reporting on / complaining about the sort of takeover of the list by celebrities and Navy SEALs. Maybe not complaining so much about the Navy SEALs. But this week I'm sort of happy to report we've still got a lot of those guys, but there's a bit of a new trend. There's sort of a little boomlet in books about conspiracy and weird phenomenon. We've got Jerome Corsi. Remember him?
Yes, he kind of right-wing expose guy.
Yeah, Swift Boat, Veterans for Truth, Abomination, books like that. He is back at number six with Where's the Birth Certificate? You know, just in case you thought Donald Trump had forced an answer to this question several weeks ago, apparently not. That book is selling. And then down at just below at number seven, Annie Jacobson has her history of Area 51, the sort of mysterious government secret military installation out in Nevada. All sorts of revelations in there. I have not had time to read all of it yet. And then down at number 11, John Ronson, the gonzo British journalist, is back with a book called The Psychopath Test.
Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah, so here, it's sort of a little hard to describe. He sort of begins by investigating a scientific hoax, or what he thinks is a scientific hoax, and then he sort of gets sucked into this world of psychologists who try to define and identify psychopaths. So he sort of travels all over the place, visiting insane asylums, you know, university laboratories, a couple of corporate offices. One of his arguments is that psychopaths actually run the world. They're much more likely to rise to the top in various organizations, not newspapers, of course.
So we know about psychopaths, but what's the test?
Well, he interviews a researcher named Hare, who has developed this 20-point checklist for identifying the psychopaths among us. So, you know, the traits you look for are, you know, glib, superficial charm, grandiose sense of self, proneness to boredom and need for stimulation, shallow affect, lack of realistic long-term goals. I don't know. That does not describe anybody that I know.
Sounds like my performance evaluation from last year. Let's apply the psychopath test to the bestseller list. Any wackos on the list?
Well, I think that John Ronson would say yes. I think that our lawyers would like me to say no comment. But just in case you're wondering, Ronson doesn't sort of give himself a totally clean bill of psychological health. He consults the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the big book that psychiatrists use. He concludes that he has no less than 12 mental ailments, including general anxiety disorder, arithmetic learning disorder, caffeine-induced disorder, and malingering.
Malingering. Ouch. Thank you, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.